You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
It's finished at Sunderland. Manchester United have done all they can. That Rooney goal was enough for the 3 points. Manchester City are still alive here. Balotelli, Aguero!
With that goal from Argentine striker Sergio Aguero at the dying minutes of the final match on May 13, 2012, Manchester City were crowned English champions for the first time in 44 years at the last game of the season, as they beat Queen's Park Rangers to the title on goal difference over their rivals Manchester United. It was a far cry to the same fixture just 4 years ago in 2008, which City finished 9th in the table and were torn apart by 13th placed Middlesbrough by 8-1. City defender Richard Dunn was sent off in just 15 minutes, and Middlesbrough striker Alphonso Alves scoring 3 goals for his side.
Richard Dunn's 14th minute red card for clipping Tunshai's ankle was the start of a humiliating capitulation. Stuart Downing smashed in the spot kick. No chance at all for Andreas Isaksson. With the captain missing from the heart of their defence, City's backline looked far from secure. Alphonso Alves found plenty of space to stretch Borough's lead. The striker set up by a cleverly disguised pass from fellow Brazilian Fabio Rockenbach. Eriksson's already had talks about returning to one of his former clubs, Benfica, a revelation that left many City followers downhearted. And their bad week continued to get worse and worse. Downing's second of the match, the midfielder reached his personal target of 10 for the season in style. The first time this campaign, Middlesbrough had netted 3 goals in a game, and just 2 minutes later, the Riverside was rocking again. Isaksson's touch kept Alves waiting, but Gelson's despairing lunge could only help the ball over the line. The 5th goal in 6 appearances for Middlesbrough's record signing, and it was one-way traffic. City's faces were as red as the home side shirts as they squandered possession cheaply in midfield and Adam Johnson capitalised. 5-0 thanks to a hefty deflection, and still 19 minutes for the visiting team to endure. Everything Borough touched turned to gold. Rockenbach's wonderful free kick carried the scoreline beyond the home fans' wildest dreams. Rockenbach was enjoying an outstanding match, and when he played in Jeremy Aliadier with 7 minutes to go, the Frenchman piled on yet more misery. This week's news that City will play in the UEFA Cup next season, qualifying unexpectedly via the fair play rankings, has been a small consolation in turbulent times. Elano's rocket raised another rare smile. Among the supporters, at least. The players couldn't wait for the final whistle. Borough, by contrast, were relishing every moment. Their biggest top-flight success for 58 years, wrapped up with a minute remaining. A milestone for Alves, his first ever hat-trick in English football. The finish as simple as they come for the striker. 8-1, and undoubtedly one of the worst afternoons of Eriksson's career.
That September saw a move that would change world football forever, when the Abu Dhabi United Group, owned by Sheikh Mansour bin Zayed Al Nahyan, announced its purchase of Manchester City. Immediately afterwards, the club announced on the day after the Abu Dhabi takeover the signing of Brazilian international Robinho from Real Madrid for £32.5 million, an enormous price tag back then. The club now is owned by the City Football Group, a holding company owned by the Abu Dhabi United Group. James Tapp explains who Mansour is and the management team that is in charge.
Mansour is of much greater importance than just owning Manchester City, as his arm, the Abu Dhabi United Group Investment and Development Limited, owns 86.21% of the City Football Group, which also own Mumbai City FC, Melbourne City FC, Montevideo City Torque, New York City, Yokohama, Girona FC, and Sichuan FC. Now, Mansour is more than just football. His company, Abu Dhabi United Group Investment and Development Limited, is an oil company. He is also a board member of the Supreme Petroleum Council, a chairman of the Executive Affairs Authority of Abu Dhabi. He is the Deputy Prime Minister of the United Arab Emirates. His half-brother is the President of the United Arab Emirates. He has a 32% stake in Virgin Galactic. And he owns the Abu Dhabi Media Investment Corporation, which helped establish Sky News Arabia. as well as Mansour being heavily tied to the United Arab Emirates, so is his chairboard, especially Khaldun Al Mubarak. Now, Mubarak is currently the group CEO and is the managing director of the Mubadala Investment Company. He also serves as the chairman of the Executive Affairs Authority of Abu Dhabi. He's the chairman of Emirates Nuclear Energy Corporation and the chairman of the Emirates Global Aluminium. He's also a board member of the Abu Dhabi Supreme Petroleum Council as well, meaning that the board of the City Football Group also makes up a good portion of the deciding councils in the United Arab Emirates.
Club sponsors also have close ties with its owners. Etihad Airways, which signed a 10-year sponsorship deal with City in 2011, including kits and naming rights to the club's stadium, is Abu Dhabi's state-owned airline. Etisalat, an Abu Dhabi telecommunications company, as well as the Emirates Tourism Agency, also have partnerships with Manchester City. Since the Abu Dhabi takeover, City elevated from mediocrity to one of the world's most known sporting brands. It won the Premier League 4 times in 8 years and currently has one of the best teams in world football, as well as becoming a regular at the European continental club competition, the Champions League. The cost to achieve that has been more than £1 billion, and Europe's football governing body, UEFA, stepped in and introduced Financial Fair Play, or FFP, to stop what then-President Michel Platini called as quote-unquote financial doping. James Tapp explains more.
These financial fair play regulations were introduced in 2009 to help reduce club losses, increase transparency and credibility of all European clubs, with many going down under due to bankruptcy, from short-term investments instead of playing on the long term. It was also brought in to encourage clubs to operate on the basis of their own revenues instead of bringing monies from outside of the club, as well as to encourage long-term beneficial spending.
Under FFP rules, clubs need to balance football-related expenditure, such as transfers and wages, with their own income from television deals, tickets and revenues raised by their commercial departments, like sponsors. While the FFP regulations are complex, clubs could only at most have €30 million of losses over 3 seasons. UEFA has sanctioned clubs for breaching FFP regulations before, with bans from participating at European competitions or signing new players and fines. Manchester City itself once faced these sanctions in 2014 for not breaking even over the past 2 years and were fined €60 million and had their squad reduced to 21 players and had restrictions imposed on transfer and salary spending. In November 2018, leaked documents to German news magazine Der Spiegel claims that Manchester City management has manipulated contracts to bypass financial fair play rules by disguising the money provided by their owners as legitimate sponsors. The money, according to Der Spiegel, came from City's owner, the Abu Dhabi United Group, and in the club's finance director, Andrew Whittleson's words, quote, routed through the partners, and they then forward to us. For example, in an email by City club executive Simon Pierce to Abu Dhabi investment company ABA in 2010, the company would only sponsor £3 million out of a £50 million contract. The remaining £12 million, according to Pierce, quote, will come from alternative sources provided by His Highness. Etihad also played along as well. While its contract to Manchester City in 2013 was worth £35 million, Pierce wrote to the airline in December that year, telling them its financial contribution, quote, remains constant at £8 million. The same was in 2015, when Etihad needed to pay £67.5 million each year as part of the agreement. City's chief financial officer, George Chumilas, told Simon Pierce that out of those £67.5 million, £8 million should be funded directly by Etihad, while the rest, £59.5 million, would be provided by the Abu Dhabi United Group. Club executives also drew up new approaches to circumvent financial fair play rules by shifting operational costs away from the club, and so from financial scrutinizers from UEFA. The operation, reviewed by Der Spiegel, was called Project Longbow. According to leaked emails, Manchester City's chief legal advisor, Simon Clifff, described Longbow was, quote, the weapon the English used to beat the French at Crecy at Agincourt, a reference to two English victories during the Hundred Years' War against France. The project involved in creating subsidiaries to take care of the costs of some standard business activities of the club. For example, while normal practices mean professional football clubs have to pay their players for the right to use them in club marketing material, Manchester City's players' marketing rights were sold to a company called Fordham Sports Management. That means the external company, not City, will be paying for the club's marketing. Not only could it cut costs for the club, selling players' marketing rights could also bring more commercial revenue, making it look better for financial fair play regulations. But Fordham Sports Management also has ties to the Abu Dhabi royal family, according to Der Spiegel's investigation. The company was owned by two Britons, Jonathan Rowland and his father David. David Rowland has always been, according to Der Spiegel, quote, considered a close ally of the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi. A concept paper reviewed by the leaks also showed how Fordham Sports Management was only one element in a closed payment loop to let Abu Dhabi inject money into City secretly. City's owner, the Abu Dhabi United Group, would first transfer money, which was £11 million in 2013, according to an email from City club executive Simon Pierce to Jonathan Rowland, to the Rowland Family Trust, and it will go through a company in the British Virgin Islands, then to a UK shell company, before arriving at Fordham Sports Management, which it will be used to buy players' image rights from Manchester City. City has since refuted Der Spiegel's allegations, but UEFA started to investigate these claims in March 2019. On the Friday before last week, Manchester City was banned from European club competitions for the next two seasons by UEFA after being found to have committed, quote, serious breaches of licensing and financial fair play regulations. They were also fined €30 million. City has once again denied these charges, saying in a statement, quote, simply put, this is a case initiated by UEFA, prosecuted by UEFA, and judged by UEFA, and they will appeal to the Court of Arbitration of Sport in Lausanne, Switzerland. Here's the club's chief executive officer, Ferran Soriano, talking to the club's official website.
The most important thing I have to say today is that the allegations are not true. They're simply not true.
And in terms of the owner putting his own money into the football club via sponsorships?
The owner has not put money in this club that has not been properly declared. We are a sustainable football club. We are profitable. We don't have debt. Our accounts have been scrutinized many times by auditors, by regulators, by investors, and this is perfectly clear.
The club was very aggressive in its statement, calling it a prejudice process when we posted it on Friday, and that was kind of a new tone for us. Why was that?
Well, this was our experience. This is the way we felt all the way through this process. Of course, a lot of people come now and say, what were you expecting? This is the way it works. You should have expected a negative outcome, the way the system is designed. But we didn't believe that. We worked very hard. We provided all kind of evidence. But at the end, this FFP investigatory chamber relied more on out-of-context stolen emails than all the other evidence that we provided on what actually happened. And I think it's normal that we feel like we feel, ultimately, based on our experience and our perception. This seems to be less about justice and more about politics.
Amnesty International's Gulf Cooperation Council researcher Devin Kenny said for Abu Dhabi, Manchester City and other sporting projects presented an opportunity to quote-unquote spots-wash a clean image for itself and divert attention away from the United Arab Emirates' poor human rights record.
The UAE has had a branding strategy in the last couple of decades, which is essentially they wanted to go from being a country that wasn't particularly known to being a country whose name people would recognize, and then would associate with things like gleaming hypermodern cities, a high level of wealth, an attractive place to visit, and then most recently also sort of the owner of prestige projects in many countries, but including in Western countries and especially in the United Kingdom. So the purchase of the Manchester City team by one of the Emirati royals was part of this process. And yeah, it's essentially just intended to get A, to get the Emirates name out there, and B, to have people, the first thing that they think and associate with the United Emirates is something positive and attractive and innocuous. So in this case, a beloved UK football team.
Kenny said the UAE has restrictions on freedom of speech, as people were banned from criticizing the government. Officials and members of the six royal families who ruled the seven Emirates of the country.
There are two primary concerns about human rights in the UAE, which are interrelated. The first concern is that there's simply no space for freedom of expression, and especially political or socially critical expression at all. Which then leads into the second concern, which is that the fairly small number of people who have transgressed the boundaries of what the regime considers acceptable speech have been imprisoned for doing so. The largest instance of this was in a mass trial that Amnesty calls the UAE 94 trial, because there were 94 defendants. This sort of had its beginnings in 2011 in the very minor Emirati version of the Arab Spring. It was formally started in 2012 and was completed in 2013. It encompassed a lot of people, 94 defendants, but a substantial number were dragged together under what the UAE called a Muslim Brotherhood-led conspiracy to overthrow the government. But in fact, they included academics, lawyers, fairly prominent figures from Emirati society, including some people who had formerly served in government and who basically were just united by having had somewhat critical views of the government. So Amnesty recently tallied what we call prisoners of conscience throughout the GCC states, the Gulf Cooperation Council. Prisoner of conscience for Amnesty means someone who's imprisoned solely for peaceful expression of their views or for political thought. And we came up with over 20 prisoners of conscience in the United Arab Emirates, which is quite high even in comparison with its neighbors. And I should add specifically, this includes a fellow named Ahmed Mansour, who was very well known in international human rights circles. He sat on the Middle East Board of Human Rights Watch. He was detained in 2017 and ultimately sentenced to 10 years in prison. And the charges turn entirely on speech. They all boil down to him saying critical things on social media. He has been, very little information gets out of the prison, but from what we're able to gather, he's been on hunger strike for, I believe, roughly about 2 months now, and his health seems to be getting into a critical state. So he's not the only case, but he's a pretty emblematic case of how critical voices are treated by the Emirati government.
Political rights for Emirati citizens are also severely limited.
Political rights are essentially absent. The Emirates is an autocracy. I don't think that's controversial. They're pretty much openly an authoritarian government, and that's in their constitution and has been the form of government they've openly taken since they became an independent state in 1971. In recent years, they've added a body, they call it the Federal National Council, which is sometimes sort of labeled as a legislature, but it's not actually a legislature because it can't pass legislation. Its constitutional role is just limited to advising the circle of ruling families who actually issue all legislation and control all political affairs in the country. The Federal National Council, or the quasi-legislative body, they held elections for it, but this doesn't really amount to an expression of political rights for two reasons. First, because it lacks legislative powers, so it's not an effective vehicle for giving citizens a political voice. And secondly, because even the votes that have been held, the people who can vote are selected by the ruling families in each respective emirate. The criteria by which they choose them aren't clear. At this point, I believe about 1/3 of Emiratis are allowed to vote, but it's simply determined behind closed doors through who knows what criteria, what people are going to be given the franchise. And until very recently, the numbers, the proportion of the population was quite small. I believe it's still not a majority, but it's only recently that it's even become a fairly large fraction of the population.
Other than citizens' rights, the protection of the rights of migrant workers, who made up 88.5% of the UAE's population, are also questioned by human rights organizations. According to Human Rights Watch, many of these low-paid migrant workers, who are recruited from South Asian countries like India, Bangladesh, and Pakistan to build the UAE's grand skyscrapers, malls, and airports, remain acutely vulnerable to forced labor, despite some reforms, as working and living conditions were unforgiving. After working for 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, in temperatures as high as 50 degrees, migrant workers are cramped in guarded labor camps in filthy conditions, and they are paid less than $200 per month. The kafala, or visa sponsorship system, that ties migrant workers to their employers, meaning workers are trapped with their employers regardless of how they are treated, creating a form of slavery. Workers' passports are taken away upon their arrival in the UAE, and they are treated with fines or deportation if they wanted to quit their job. Moreover, on the international front, the UAE has also been involved in several regional conflicts, especially with the civil war in Yemen, since it supports President Abdel Mansour Hadi's government with the Saudi Arabia-led coalition. Human Rights Watch has said abuses by UAE proxy forces include the use of excessive force during arrests, detaining family members of wanted suspects to pressure them to quote-unquote voluntarily turn themselves in, arbitrarily detaining men and boys, detaining children with adults, or forcibly disappearing dozens were documented. But Manchester City also proved the UAE a useful tool on international diplomacy. During the Arab Spring in the early 2010s, protests threatened the rule of autocratic dictators and absolute monarchies across the Arab world in North Africa and the Gulf. Tunisia's Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, Yemen's Ali Abdullah Saleh, Libya's Muammar Gaddafi's long rule of their respective countries ended during these protests. But changes in Egypt caused the most concern in Abu Dhabi, after Hosni Mubarak was forced out in 2011 and replaced by Mohamed Morsi, who is aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood, an organization branded an existential threat by the UAE. To deter the UK from normalizing relationships with the new Cairo government, the UAE in 2012 threatened to block £1 billion arms deals, stop inward investment, and cut intelligence cooperation if Downing Street did not act against the Muslim Brotherhood. Before Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed went to London to meet then-British Prime Minister David Cameron, he was not briefed by career diplomats, but by Manchester City club executive Simon Pearce. In his briefing papers, Pearce suggested that Mohammed bin Zayed should tell Cameron that the BBC had been infiltrated by Muslim Brotherhood sympathisers and the UK needed a, quote, measured public approach in dealing with the Brotherhood. When that didn't work out, Abu Dhabi signalled its displeasure with the UK through commercial and political pressure. In 2012, BP was temporarily excluded from bidding for an extension to onshore oil concessions in the Gulf. And at the end of 2013, the UAE dropped its £60 billion deal to buy 60 Typhoon fighter jets from British aerospace firm BAE. Afterwards, then-British ambassador in Abu Dhabi, Dominic Jemmy, was summoned to meet with Manchester City chairman Khaldun al-Mubarak and was told London needed to consider the political implications when its most important allies in the Gulf have made a stance against the Muslim Brotherhood. Yet, a month after the meeting, dozens of British military advisers to the UAE armed forces did not have their contracts renewed and were sent home. However, Abu Dhabi is not the first and only billionaire or organisation that has ties with foreign states to bankroll international sporting brands for their own purposes. its neighbouring Emirate, Dubai also sponsors multiple big-name European football brands through its own airline, Emirates. Spanish giants Real Madrid, Italian greats AC Milan, Hamburg SV of Germany, Olympiacos, the most successful club in Greece, and Portuguese champions Benfica all have Emirates as their shirt sponsors. English club Arsenal not only has the UAE airline as their shirt sponsor, but also the brand name on their home ground, the Emirates Stadium. Outside of football, the airline also has sponsors in rugby, tennis, motorsport, sailing, and cricket. Meanwhile, Qatar's quote-unquote investment in world football is indifferent to its Gulf rival. While the country has also been criticised for mistreating migrant workers and its poor human rights record, as homosexuality is still illegal, Qatar Sports Investments, which is an arm of the Qatari government, fully owns French champions Paris Saint-Germain, which boasts world stars like Neymar and Kylian Mbappe, to use as a PR machine to promote Qatar. Qatari companies like the state-owned airline Qatar Airways, the Qatari Tourism Authority, television network beIN Sports, telecoms company Ooredoo, and commercial bank QNB are all premium sponsors of the club. Qatar Airways also has sponsorship deals with Italian club AS Roma, German champions Bayern Munich, and FIFA. In addition, Qatar will also host the Football World Cup in 2022, despite allegations of bribery and corruption during the selection process. Russia is also another state to use football as a PR tool. Back in 2003, Roman Abramovich, a Russian billionaire who had close connections with Presidents Boris Yeltsin and Vladimir Putin, bought English club Chelsea and transformed it to major success in the late 2000s and throughout the 2010s. While Alisher Usmanov, another pro-Putin oligarch, bought a significant share in Arsenal in 2007. State-owned gas company Gazprom is the shirt sponsor of German club Schalke, and the club's president, Clemens Tönnies, has ties with Moscow through his other businesses. Tönnies has once said in 2011 that Vladimir Putin himself unsuccessfully tried to stop the club from selling top German goalkeeper Manuel Neuer to rivals Bayern Munich that year. Gazprom is also the main sponsor of Red Star Belgrade in Serbia, which, like Russia, are predominantly Slavic and Eastern Orthodox countries. West Asian nation Azerbaijan, which has a poor human rights record, was once into the act by sponsoring Spanish club Atletico Madrid from 2012 to 2015, and it resulted in a success, with huge investments such as new hotels and apartments in the capital Baku, and a luxury development in the Caspian Sea. Rwanda of East Africa, one of the poorest countries in the world, is now too trying to gain more international exposure by splashing money into European football, by spending £30 million in 2018 to put its name on Arsenal's shirt sleeves. President Paul Kagame, a former army commander and an Arsenal supporter who emerged victorious at the end of the country's civil war, has been president of the country since the year 2000. He changed the constitution to enable him to run for a third election in 2017, which he won with 98.8% of the vote, despite accusations of dirty tricks against those who stood against him. He claimed that the deal could bring attention to the country's tourism industry, which could offer lakeside resorts and walks with mountain gorillas. But could Manchester City being banned from European competitions change the human rights situation in Abu Dhabi, or even how football is currently financed? Amnesty International's Devin Kenny is sceptical it would make real change, but it could raise awareness on Abu Dhabi's human rights record in Europe.
I would be sceptical that it's going to lead into a direct connection that would be beneficial for human rights. I do think it's positive that there's going to be a critical eye cast on the Emirates' purchase of Manchester City, because it was done for state propaganda reasons, essentially, or to serve state interests. So it could be a useful scandal in that regards, in terms of raising public skepticism in the UK about the UAE's motives and what they're seeking to do with these sort of prestige purchases in the UK.
For the BBC's sports editor, Dan Rowan, what happens to the future of football financing remains much uncertain, as the case is now being heard by the Court of Arbitration of Sport, and it could drag onto the Swiss Federal Court or even the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, France. However, he also wrote the upcoming legal battle is a watershed moment because the stakes are very high for both UEFA and nation states bankrolling sporting brands, since national prestige and reputation is on the line. On one hand, if the punishment for City is upheld, it will further damage the club's reputation and tarnish Abu Dhabi's positive image that the royal family spent so much to upkeep. Moreover, an upheld ruling could give UEFA a more free rein to pursue the accounts of other football clubs owned by nation states and land sanctions on them. But on the other side, as British sports lawyer John Mezard told Ruan in an interview, if Manchester City are successful in getting a ruling about the process adopted by UEFA, a whole series of other clubs will be able to use it as a precedent to argue their own sanctions were unlawful as well. Yet, regardless of the outcome, the battle between UEFA and Manchester City and its nation state owners is a time that sport regulators and governing bodies are being tested like never before.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95bfm.com/bcasts.